Morning, everyone. This is week five of the series. Just a couple of announcements. First of all, next week will be the last one of this term, and then we'll take a break for a couple of weeks, and we'll start a new topic, which I'll announce next week. We're also going to draw the raffle next week, because last week we did it on Zoom. This week, well, hopefully everything will be okay, so we'll do it here, which will be nice. So there's one more week to go. Also, very big thank you for whoever arranged this cake. Thank you very much for my birthday. That was very nice of you. Please, it's here. It's full. It's very good cake. I just had some, even though I probably shouldn't. But so when we finish, please take some. Okay. So last week, just to review, last week we did the period sort of post Holocaust rebuilding. We paid a tribute to Lubavitcher Rebbe. We talked about four lessons of leadership. We're talking about that. We talked about the idea of looking forward, not being learning from the past, but not being stuck in the past. We talk about the bigger picture, but at the same time, not forgetting the details and the individual. We talked about the combination of accepting, but being demanding. In fact, not only despite being accepting, but because one is accepting and seeing the potential and seeing the soul and so on. That's why we can inspire growth. And the combination of knowledge and action, a dedication to learning, but at the same time putting it into action. Okay. So today, I'm going to do, again, we're jumping around history here, but today I'm going to do something more to do with the 12th century, the time that the 12th century was the Jewish communities in the 12th century, but with particular emphasis, I want to look at the Rambam, Maimonides, who was a fascinating, fascinating leader. If you ever visit Tveria, the city of Tveria in Israel, that's where he's buried. He didn't live in Israel, but he spent a few days in Israel in the middle of his life, but he actually died in Egypt, as we'll soon see, and he was buried in Israel in Tveria. And if you ever visit his tomb, you'll see that there's an inscription, a very fascinating inscription, which obviously whenever he was buried and there was a tomb there was inscribed, but it was always accepted by the Jewish people. So the Rambam's, and I'll tell you what it is in a moment, so the Rambam's name was Moshe, right? In fact, he's called Rambam because it's an acronym for Rabbeinu Moshe ben Maimon. Right, Moshe, the son of Maimon, hence in English, Maimonides. So D's apparently in some languages, I think Latin is the son of, and Maimon was his father. So that's why it's called Rambam or Maimonides. So his name was Moshe. So on the same as Moses, of course, Moshe Rabbeinu. So on his tomb, there's an inscription that says, Mi Moshe ad Moshe lo kam ke Moshe, which means from Moshe Rabbeinu, from the first Moses till Moses Maimonides, the Rambam, there was never anyone like Moshe, which is an incredible praise to write about someone, right? And obviously it was written not just stunned by a relative wanting to be nice, it was written by people who wanted that to be the inscription on his tomb, because he was a very, very outstanding, and just not outstanding, but unique, revolutionary, unique leader, right? And he was so all-encompassing, both in his knowledge and on his impact, that as we'll see, and there's so many lessons learned from his life, he had a tremendous, profound impact on the entire Jewish nation and beyond, non-Jews as well, which I'll talk about a little bit later. He was a Talmudist, he was a philosopher, a mystic, a doctor, a scientist, a master of ethics and personal growth. He was all of that, and he lived an incredible life. So what I want to do is I want to begin with giving you a bit of historical context and just a bit of the history about the Rambam for two reasons. First of all, it's a fascinating history, and I think it's actually important to know. I would venture to say that even those who are not so well-versed in Jewish history, but knowing about the Rambam is really important. It's a very, very essential part of the evolvement and the development of Judaism and Jewish knowledge and Jewish teaching and so on. So I'll give you a bit of history, but also it's very important to understand his history, because I think this is true with a lot of sages, but it's so fascinating when you see what kind of life he lived. And it wasn't an easy life. It was a very difficult life. And contrast that with what he produced and the influence and the impact that he had, it's truly phenomenal. So in order to understand his greatness, you really have to understand the life that he led. You know what I'm saying? So like, it's really fascinating. So I'll try to give it a bit of a summary. So the Rambam was born on Erev Pesach, actually. every mother's nightmare, right, to have a baby on Erev Pesach. Anyway, he was born on that day. The Maharal of Prague was born that day. All great people. The Rebbe was born also like a couple of days before Pesach. You always hope, you know, either 2 weeks before Pesach or like a week after Pesach. But he was born in Cordova, Spain. His father was also a great Torah scholar. His name was Maimon. They came from a very distinguished family. His father was a judge, a dayan, in the court of law in Spain. And from a very young age, it was obvious that this young Moshe was a very, very big scholar and a prodigy, and he was going to be a great person. However, he was barely bar mitzvah when the Almohads, the really intense radical Muslims, really, conquered Cordova, and this was 1148. And they were very, very savage and ruthless, and they did not tolerate any other religion besides Islam, which is fascinating. I don't know if Spain has something about it, because a couple of centuries later it was the same thing, both Christianity this time, right? So, and they offered the Jewish population a choice: you either convert to Islam or death or expulsion, one of those things, right? So the vast majority of Jews at that time left, among them the Dayan, Maimon, Ramam's father, and they went and they started wandering around, I think it was northern Spain, southern Spain. And that's where they sort of found refuge, but they were going from one place to another, and it became unbearable. And eventually, 10 years later, they joined a group of people who were leaving Spain, and they landed up in North Africa, in Morocco. And they lived for 5 years in Fez, which was then the capital of Morocco. Now, I've never traveled to Morocco, but if you have, you can actually see the house still that Ramam lived in. Wow. It's still there, yeah. It's well known. He was in Morocco, and they still have a house which is attributed to the Ramam. That's where the Ramam lived, right? But then there became a lot of religious persecution and intolerance, so he left Fez, and they traveled to Egypt. They were going to go to Israel. Israel was very hard to live then at that time, but they did go through Israel for a few days. He actually, at that time, the family was able to stop in Jerusalem and daven by the Kotel. They were in Hebron for a brief moment, and then they actually made their way to Egypt, and they settled in Cairo. I forgot what that part of Cairo was called. It wasn't central Cairo. It was, I'll tell you in a second. I don't know, but it was like a different part of... Fustat it was called, something like that. Which was a sort of a... That's where the Jewish people lived. It wasn't like central Cairo where the caliphate was, but it was part of Cairo. There was an established Jewish community in Cairo at the time, a Sephardi community. And he lived in Cairo for the rest of his life, right? Not an easy life, as we'll soon see, but he left Cairo for the rest of his life, and it was at that time, while in Cairo, that's when he wrote most of his works. Most of his works were written when he was a rabbi in Cairo. Now, they started to enjoy, they were settled in Cairo and things were going to be okay when Rabbi Maimon passed away young. So his father passed away and he was a young boy. But the Rambam himself was very focused on learning, and his brother, he had a brother, David, who decided to make a partnership with the Rambam. It's a famous ultra-traditional partnership called Yisachar and Zvulun. So he was a pious Jew as well. He will work, he'll do business, and he dealt in jewelry and precious gems and all kinds of things, importing, exporting, and he will support the Rambam with his family, which sounded like a really good idea. So the Rambam could throw himself into his tremendous deep study, and it would be an amazing arrangement. However, unfortunately, tragedy struck again, and not long afterwards, he was on a sea voyage on business, and his boat capsized and drowned together with his whole fortune, and the family was left with nothing. So it fell on the Rambam to then support his own family, to support his brother's family, and it was very, very tough. He became ill for a while, the Rambam, as a result, and recovered. And then he was very focused on a particular idea, which is an amazing idea. He was one of the few Jewish leaders or rabbis that refused to take any physical benefit from his Torah teaching. So he was adamant to support himself other than his rabbinic leadership. And that's when he became a doctor.
Wow.
Right. He was already very well versed in science.
How old was he then?
He died when he was 70. So no, he was. I guess this must have been 30, 40. I'm not sure exactly when it was. Yeah, and he was older. Already he studied a lot of the stuff before, but he decided then to, I guess the qualifications weren't as formal as they are today, but he became an amazing physician, well sought after, and he became he became the personal physician of the Sultan, Saladin, right? The Sultan of Egypt at the time, yeah. Which also had an interesting impact on the Rambam's life, because there's a letter which the Rambam wrote once to someone, saying someone who was asking his counsel, asking him to write them, and he was excusing himself why he doesn't have a lot of time, and he wrote to this person his schedule. Right? Now he lived, the Rambam wasn't able to live near the Sultan because Jews didn't live there. There was religious freedom in Cairo at the time, but I don't know if you know, in the Muslim lands, even when Jews were able to practice Judaism freely, they were always considered second-class citizens. It was like a whole system. I forgot, there's an Arabic word for it. What's it called? Yeah, Timmy something, that's right, yeah. Where their shuls had to be lower than the mosques, and like had to pay extra taxes, and they couldn't live in the same... They were relatively free in a lot of places, not all Muslim lands. It's a very fascinating history. In the Muslim lands, Jews were for a large part, able to have big communities, have schools, teach, have rabbis, practice freely. But there was always this thing, as long as they were subjugated, so to speak, wrong, they surrendered to the Muslim population as second-class citizens. So even as the private physician of the Sultan, he wasn't able to live near the Sultan, nor did he want to. He wanted to live in Fustat, which was near the Jewish community. So he writes over there in his letter that he gets up early in the morning. He has to go to central Cairo by horse. Right? So he goes there, and it's quite a distance by horse. He has to check on the Sultan, his wife, his family, consult them, spends a good few hours there, until he's able then eventually to take a horse and come back to where he lives in Fustat. He says, as I come home, I'm already very tired from the way. There's a room full of people, patients waiting to consult, right? Jews and non-Jews. So he says he has to excuse himself and he has to ask them just for a few minutes break so he can just rest for a few minutes and eat something, which he writes there is his only meal of the day. Then he sees all the patients, which goes and prescribes them. He says prescribes the medicines. We'll get to that a little bit later. It's interesting. This concept of prescribing herbs and medicine is very much begins with the Rambam. And he eventually is late at night. Only then he's able to learn and write. And then eventually he goes to sleep for a few hours and he starts again, right? And he writes then, Shabbat is one great day, because Shabbat then, all the Jews in the... Obviously he didn't go to the Sultan on Shabbat, but on Shabbat all the Jews of the community come to his house on Shabbat afternoon and they study. That's right. So that was Rambam. Now in all of this, he managed to produce all of his unbelievable works in the schedule, right? Which is absolutely incredible. It goes to something that actually is talked about or hinted to in last week's weekly parasha, that, and Pirkei Avot talks about it as well, that comfort doesn't necessarily produce scholarship, right? It's very interesting. Hard work does. And if a person is dedicated to scholarship, sometimes it's the absence of material comfort that actually leaves room for spiritual growth. It doesn't have to be, but particularly for academic progress and scholarship, which is amazing. Because I've told you that the Talmud was produced in a time of great persecution, and some of the greatest works were produced with people who didn't have time, didn't have comfort, and had tremendous stress, which is incredible. So what were his works? I'll just tell you like this. So first of all, the Rambam was an amazing Talmudist, right? He wrote one of his great works. He wrote was the commentary on the Mishnah. But his magnum opus in terms of Torah scholarship is what we call the Mishnah Torah. And this was an amazing... I'll just give you a little bit of a background to it, because it comes up later to understand the controversy around the Rambam. The Rambam wrote... By the way, it was his only book that he wrote in Hebrew. Everything else he wrote in Arabic. Because one of the things with the Rambam is he was very... In his time, he was ahead of his time completely. In his time, he was very focused on making his teachings accessible to the masses. Right? And inspiring the masses. And bringing scholarship to the masses. And that's one of the reasons that he wrote a lot of his work in Arabic. In fact, all the works of the Rambam we have today, which are all in Hebrew, it's not his Hebrew, it's translated. And you can tell, because it's not as good as the one book he wrote in Hebrew. The language is a little bit difficult, because, you know, translation is always a little bit harder than the original, right? So this was an amazing work. So what he did was like this. Up until then, all the Jewish laws were centered in the Talmud and in the commentaries that came after the Talmud, which was a period of 500 years called the Geonim, which were great Babylonian scholars who wrote responsa, and they wrote an analysis in the Talmud and in-depth Jewish law and so on and so forth. But clear, concise Jewish law was all over the place. See, the Talmud is 20 volumes, right? But the Talmud is really a record of oral discussion. So when you learn Talmud, first of all, you don't get a clear law. You get discussion, analysis, arguments, debates, which is fascinating, and it's part of Jewish scholarship. But you don't get a clear conclusion. So how are we supposed to behave? What are we supposed to do? And also, it's very, like, if you want to know the laws of Shabbat, right? Yes, so there is a volume of Talmud that have the laws of Shabbat, or the laws of business, or the laws of Hanukkah, whatever. But you'll find them all over the place because it's an oral discussion, and it was someone taking minutes of an oral discussion. So you could have a discussion where someone's talking about the laws of Shabbat, and suddenly someone brings up a question, and they go off a tangent, and then they're talking about the laws of Hanukkah and the laws of something else, and right? So it's confusing. Post-Talmud, there was a lot of questions that arose, and there was a huge amount of literature, but it was not misudar, as I say. It wasn't organized, it wasn't codified, it wasn't clarified. So the Rambam took it upon himself to write a book, which he did in 14 volumes. Each volume had different sections to cover in a very clear, accessible way and clear language the entire Torah, the entire laws of the Torah. Now, if you learn Rambam, which I do daily, I have a daily study of Rambam, it is absolutely fascinating that a human being could do this in those times. Because what had to happen was, he had to have in his mind absolutely clear the entire Talmud and the entire literature that was ever written to date until he was alive, in order to then organize it into organized sections, you know what I'm saying? And the clarity and language, it's just unbelievable. His idea was to make it very accessible, just to, so that, and he writes in his introduction, it's not that he discourages the study of Talmud, but he says lots of people can't do it, lots of people don't know what to do, because we don't have, like today, we have lots of different codes of Jewish law, books, rule books, and so on. He says he wants people to be able to learn the Chumash, skip all the way to his book, and know what to do, right? There's a lot of depth in the Rambam, obviously, because a lot of it is his conclusions are the way he understood the Talmud. Not everyone agreed with him all the time. So today, Rambam is studied actually not as a rule book. It's very fascinating. It's actually not studied the way it was meant to be in the beginning. Today we study Rambam, just first of all, general knowledge, but also it's studied in yeshivas. We all learn Rambam and yeshiva as a way to analyze the Talmud. Like we'll learn a piece of Talmud and see how the Rambam summarized that Talmud. And then you could see, oh, one second, that's a couple of words that are interesting there. It means he understood it differently the way I've understood it, and we need to understand that and go into it. So it's a very fascinating study. But anyway, in his time, it was meant to be a handbook, which was very, very widely accepted eventually, particularly by the Yemenite Jews, interestingly enough. He didn't live in Yemen, but he had a very big connection, as we'll see, with the Yemenite Jews. And what happened was the Yemenite Jews were very, they were, you know, they're a community until today. I mean, now there's not many left, but when the Yemenite Jews came to Israel, they've been there for generations. They were not a wandering community. And because of that, they actually always were dedicated to the Rambam. And the Yemenite Jews, even today, some of them, they live their observant life based on the Rambam, not based on other books that came later, which we do. But so it's interesting. There was a special connection. Now, so that was his magnum opus, and that's an unbelievable piece of work. He also wrote a commentary on the Mishnah, as I said. He wrote the Sefer HaMitzvot, the book of Mitzvot, to summarize all 630 Mitzvot. In the commentary to the Mishnah, there's the very famous, because he was a codifier, the Rambam was a codifier, besides being a scholar, right? There's a very famous, what we call the 13 principles of Jewish faith. Now, if you've ever been to Shul Friday night, you know there's a song that they sing in most shuls called Yigdal, right? Yigdal Elokim Chai, right? That's 13 paragraphs. It's based on the Rambam's 13 principles of faith. Some people say it every single day. It's the belief in one God, monotheism, the idea of prayers, reward and punishment, the belief in prophecy, the belief in Torah from Sinai, and of course, ultimately, the belief in the coming of Mashiach. Now, what's interesting is that this is 500 years ago, 600 years ago, for the last 500 years, 600 years, all communities of Orthodox Jewry, no matter what stripe or color they are all based on the Rambam's 13 principles of faith. That's kind of the influence he had, right? I mean, the values are there before, the concepts were there in the Talmud already, but the way he put it, so there's like the benchmark, you could say, of Orthodox Jewry is, it starts with the 13 principles of faith, even though there's different customs, different applications of it, and so on and so forth, but this is the foundation. Like, to be considered an Orthodox community, it means you believe in the 13 principles of faith. That's the sort of benchmark, right? Now, another amazing thing that Rambam wrote was the in his commentary to a Mishnah, he wrote an introduction to Pirkei Avot. Now, I said before, besides being a Talmudist, the Rambam was a master of ethics. Right? Master of ethics. And Pirkei Avot has a lot of personal growth, ethical behavior, relationship behavior, and so on. So the Rambam wrote 8 chapters as an introduction to Pirkei Avot, right? Which became known as its own book. It's called the Shmona Prakim. Everyone knows Shmona Prakim means the 8 chapters of the Rambam, and they know what you're talking about. It's the 8 chapters of Pirkei Avot. Where he lays out very systematically the foundations of Jewish ethics, personal growth. There's a little bit of description, more in his medical books, but there's a bit of description there of mental health, some fascinating stuff. Again, ahead of his time, some of the stuff we know today, he mentions already in the Shmona Prakim about depression and about other mental health issues. And the cure of these issues, amazing stuff, and it's studied, and it's not studied as an introduction to Pirkei Avot, it's studied as its own thing. He also wrote 2 very, very famous letters. They're not letters, they... what do you call them? Like epistles or something, like huge letters. They're very, very long. One was called Igeret HaShmad, and it was a letter written for Jews to understand the threat of anti-Semitism and the force of converting, and was basically to inspire them and to encourage them to stay strong to their faith. And a particular one he wrote called Igeret Teiman. He wrote a letter to the books, to the Jews of Teiman. It was actually to the rabbi of Yemen, but to the Jews, really, of Yemen, encouraging them. And over there he talks about anti-Semitism and why there's anti-Semitism. He addresses the whole punt of anti-Semitism. Amazing stuff. Now, besides all of that, he wrote 2 other amazing things. So he was also a very big philosopher, and he studied a lot of general philosophy, secular philosophy. Aristotle and all the many Greek philosophy and a lot of it, right? So in his time, there were many Jews who didn't have access to proper Jewish education, similar like today, and they were just very confused. And they did what youth always start to do. They start looking elsewhere, right? And this bothered the Rambam because they became very confused. There were lots of Jewish questions against Judaism. They had no idea to understand what in general philosophy was compatible with Judaism, what wasn't, what is true, what isn't, what we accept, what we don't accept. And they were seeking, but they were very confused. Hence, the Rambam wrote the very famous, at the time it was very controversial, called The Guide to Perplexed, known as Moreh Nevuchim, right? In Arabic, translated a number of times into Hebrew, today's translated into English. Very difficult stuff. It's very complex philosophy. In fact, it's not even so encouraged today to study necessarily The Guide to Perplexed, because that's not the... We have more relevant sources today, so that sort of are inspiring or clear. But in its time, it was unbelievable. He is still studied by many scholars today, in which he does many things in the Guide to Perplexed. He answers a lot of questions. His approach was to offer rational explanations to many of the mitzvot, some of them which were very creative, some of them which were very controversial, actually. But at the same time, he's very dedicated and very committed to the truth and the eternity of his 13 principles, which he wrote himself. The truth of the Torah, the eternity of the Torah, the monotheistic belief, the holiness of the Torah. And therefore, was not against general philosophy, but said you always have to make, there has to be 2 conditions. It has to be dedicated to the truth, and it's got to be compatible with the teachings of the Torah. That was his framework, right? So it became a very, very philosophical work, included a lot of general philosophy, and a guide to those that were confused. That's exactly what the title says, Moreh Nevuchim, Guide to the Perplexed. And it became a source of much controversy, which I'll come to a little bit later, soon. One more thing I just need to mention, we'll spend a lot of time on the history, but I think it's fascinating, is, as I said, he was a physician, and he became a very, very famous physician. Richard the Lionhearted actually offered him to come to England and to become his personal physician. Can you imagine if Rama would have moved to England? It would be an interesting thing. Maybe he would have written books in English. That would have been interesting. But he didn't. He referred to stay in Cairo. He was already the Sultan's personal physician. He was the head of the rabbi of the community, the Jewish community there, and he preferred to stay there. But he wrote, which isn't so famous, he wrote many, many medical journals. Right? Which are not studied so much in the Jewish community because they're never published by the Jewish community. But they are published. They are known by academic scholars. In the world of medicine, they know about the Rambam's works. Right? Sorry?
He's obviously a genius.
Yeah, no, he was amazing. He was incredible, right? Yeah, he was. And I'll come to it later, because I'm going to come to a little bit of this mental health approach, which is fascinating. I'm going to talk about that. I think it's one of the lessons we can learn from him. And eventually, these were written in Arabic. They were later, some of them were translated into Latin. And they've been used. They've been quoted and used throughout the ages in medical research and the medical field. And then when he was close to 70 years old, in the year 1204, in the month of Tevet, he took ill and he passed away at the age of 70. His wish was to be buried in Israel, and he was taken to Israel, and he was buried in the city of Tveria, where you can find his graveside even today. There's a little bit of controversy around that, because there is a tradition in Cairo that he was buried in Cairo, but the accepted historic view is that he was buried in Israel, and people visit his tomb today in Israel. What I found quite fascinating is, last week we talked about the Lubavitcher Rebbe. One of his campaigns was to have a daily study of Rambam, which I do. And many years ago, when I visited the Rambam's grave for the first time, I found it very fascinating to study a bit of Rambam at his grave, which was an amazing thing to do. All right. Now, what I want to do is, for the time we have left, is explore some of the lessons that we can learn from the Rambam. I'm going to touch on four things. The first is, as I said before, he was a master of personal growth. He wrote books on it and journals about it and so on. But already in his magnum opus, the halachic Rambam, where he goes through all the laws of the Torah, he has a section called the Hilchot Deot, which means the laws of things you have to know, right? Where he has a whole section on behavior, health, physical health, the famous Rambam diet, which actually is making a bit of comeback nowadays. Interesting. It's already the Rambam wrote then in the 12th century, where, I'm talking about more from a health point of view, right? It's there where he says, eat more vegetables, less fruit, right? All the way back then, all that kind of stuff. Yes. Eat his main part of his diet, which is the most hard to keep, is you never eat till you're full. You've got to eat till you, I think he says, three quarters full or something like that. And then it digests later and you feel full. Okay, that's the part that's hard, right? And in that section, he goes through a laws of how we conduct ourselves with our emotional responses to other people, our personality, and how we live. And there he has the famous concept, which you mentioned before, but I want to just do it in the context of this discussion. He says two amazing things. First of all, his one very, very famous foundation is the golden rule, the middle of the road rule, right? He says God gave us all different types of emotions. Some are better, some are worse, some are negative, some are positive. However, all of them need to be understood in the context where they become negative when they become extreme. So for example, he says a person, I'll just read you one line, he says a person should not be a person that gets angry all the time, but nor should it be like a dead person that has no feelings. Right? So in other words, when you move away from something, you've got to be careful. Don't kill off an emotion to the point where you then go to the other extreme, and then you become a person who is lacking the positive sides of that emotion, right? Like, anger is a terrible thing, but nevertheless, the good side of anger is the passion, right? The passion of it, you know. I once heard a little cute story. There was this a very famous sage, just lived in the last generation. He was in Israel, post-Holocaust. His name was Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, a very, very smart man. And they once came to him and they said like this, they didn't know what to do in a certain shul. There's a certain paragraph in the Shabbat davening that there's certain, it's called Avarachamim, when we remember all the martyrs of all the generations, we say when we say Yiskar, but we say it every Shabbat in Shul, except for certain days that are more happier days, certain days we leave out this paragraph. And then there's certain Shabbatot that there's a difference of custom, some Shul say it, some Shul don't say it. So they went to Shlomo Zalman Auerbach with a big problem, because the whole politics has broken out in the shul, and I say it's a terrible thing. People are arguing. Every time it comes this particular Shabbat, half the shul screams, "We've got to say Avarachmim," other shuls say, "Don't have to say Avarachmim." And there's always this big machloikas, this big thing. And what are we going to do about the shul? What should we do about this? It's not a good thing. People shouldn't argue like that. So in his great wisdom, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said like this. He said, "You know, it's actually not such a terrible thing that they're arguing about it." He says, "There's going to come a time where, God forbid, there's not going to be an argument if you say it or don't say it, because no one's going to care." Yeah, well, sometimes there's a good side to this argument, right? Which reminds me, nothing to do with it, but I'll just share with you anyways. It reminds me of a little joke they say about a shul also that had a big a fight broke out about what the particular minhag is in that shul about a particular kaddish, if you say it at this point or not. And there was no one who remembered the authentic, original custom of the shul. So originally, I found someone who was an old member of the shul, and he was in an old age home. He couldn't really speak properly. He could communicate non-verbally. And they thought, let's hop around. Let's try and at least talk to him while he's still alive and try. So they came to him and they said to him, Ramesh, whatever his name was, he says, we have this big thing in the shul. So tell me, was the original custom of the shul to say this Kaddish at this time? And he says, So the guy's happy. So the other guy's a little bit upset. He says, what? The minhag is not to say the Kaddish? He says, no. Yes to the Kaddish? No. Now they're all confused. Yes, no. So the two guys start fighting. So he says, as if that's the custom. The custom is to fight about it. That was always the custom. All right. So anyway, so Rambam says, Midah Benanit, there's always a good part of every emotion. You have to always take the middle road. And he says, therefore, a person shouldn't be a person that always is being like a comedian, making jokes and scoffing and making fun of the things. But you shouldn't be a depressed person and sad and walk around all the time. You gotta be able to crack a joke too, right? That thing. He says you shouldn't indulge, but you shouldn't live a life of abstinence. You gotta eat food. You gotta eat properly. You gotta eat healthy. All those things has gotta be always that balance. That's this concept of the thing. Then he says a very, very important thing, which I think again is something that's so relevant today, and people talk about it today, and so on and so forth. But Rambam wrote about it in the 12th century, and he says the following. Rambam was very big in his medical writings particularly, but even in the Rambam itself, to highlight the connection between, or to highlight the existence of an illness which is not physical. Mental health, emotional illness, whatever the case is. And he writes and he says, there's something called cholei haguf, which is the sickness of the body, right? But he says there are those people who have a sickness because just like if you have a physical illness where you eat and you have like an addiction to the wrong thing and you eat the wrong physical things and so on and so forth, right? You also have spiritual, emotional illness where people are just trapped in what he calls emotional sickness. They are attached to, he says, like mit'avin v'ohavin hade'ot hara'ot. They love and they pursue bad practices, bad emotional responses. And they kind of despise the healthy and constructive way. And they might even know that it's like that, but that they can't help themselves, right? Umitatzlin, they're just lazy to go in the right path. Or he brings a pasuk in Isaiah, which says they confuse darkness with light and light with darkness. That was, they have no clarity. They're trapped in negative emotions and so on and so forth. So he says, what do you do? He says, I was reading Hebrew, it's beautiful writing. He says, Mahi takanat cholei hanefashot. What is the solution for the people who are sick in their soul, not in their body? He says the same thing. You have to get help. Yelchu etzel hachamim shein rofei hanefashot. You should go to those wise people who heal souls. Something like that, all right? You got to go to people who are able to help you. In other words, the thing which we know today, although even though we know it today, it's not, people don't always do this. You have to reach out for help. A person cannot help themselves. Just like you can't help yourself with your heart disease, you can't help yourself with these diseases. Now, a person can help himself if it's not in the context of a pathology, of a sickness. And even then, you need to get inspiration from others, you need to get inspiration from what you read and what you learn. But when it becomes a sickness, says you need to reach out for help. You cannot do it yourself, and therefore he creates this concept, which is such a common concept today, the concept of a rafei nefashot, those who heal the mind or heal the soul, right? It doesn't mean soul is a spiritual thing necessarily, it means the healing of the mind, which we know today as therapists, psychologists, psychiatrists, whatever the case is, counselors, coaches, whatever, right? Rabbis a little bit too, sometimes, yeah, right? So that's what he says, you have to reach out to them, those who are wise, those who are qualified to reach. So I think it's an amazing thing, and it's something which began, I think you find it more in the writings of the Rambam than you do in other writings of those times, and it's a real, ahead of his time, so to speak, highlighting these issues, which are, today become part of sort of the everyday today language, although not everyone has internalized it. I mean, we know even from the last year, people are struggling, and not everyone reaches out, and it's a very bad thing, because it's taboo, because it's embarrassed, whatever the case is, but it's a really important thing to be able to internalize. So that's the first concept. The second one is a beautiful piece of the Rambam that I'm going to share with you, which I've shared with you in the past, but it teaches us a lot about the concept of giving. So the Rambam very famously constructed these 8 levels of giving charity, right? Based on the Talmud and everything, but it's, again, he put it together and he says the following, and you can learn a lot from what the Rambam says. I'm not going to go through all 8, but I'm just going to highlight a few very, very important lessons. So he says the lowest level of giving tzedakah, of giving charity, which, by the way, giving charity doesn't necessarily mean physical money. It could be any help, right? But he says the lowest level is when someone gives unwillingly. You give because you have to. It's an obligation. So a person asks for help, so you give it to them, right? Now, the Rambam includes that in the levels of charity because although that's the lowest level, as he puts it, right? But it's still giving. You can never take away giving, right? And this is an important thing. Although we talk about there's a way to give and there's a proper way to give and there's a way to give with dignity and respect and connection and lifting of someone's spirits and so on and so forth, but at the end of the day, a person should never say, well, you know, I'm not giving with a full heart, so I'm not going to give. No, that's a very bad thing to do, right? A person should be in the habit of helping, even if it's hard. In the habit of giving, even when it's difficult. So, even though it's the lowest level, it is the lowest rung, the Rambam says, but giving unwillingly is still giving. So that's an important lesson we can learn from that. Of course, he goes up. He says a lesser level is when someone gives inadequately, but gives gladly and with a smile. Right? So maybe he didn't do enough, but he's giving it this time at least. And I've quoted this piece of the Talmud many, many times in this discussion, where the Talmud says that if you give a coin to a poor person, you get blessed with 3 blessings. If you give it and you lift the spirits of the poor person, there's like 11 blessings, right? Because this is what we need to know, that the important part of giving is not just what you give. Giving is very important. Helping the person is very important, but it's the way we give. Because the giving to another person, and giving doesn't mean necessarily someone who's poor in money. It could be poor in lots of things. It could be poor in skills, poor in emotional health, whatever the case is, right? Emotional support or other support, moral support. But you're giving to someone who doesn't have, and the person doesn't have whatever they don't have, means they're lacking not only in the particular resource that you're giving them, but they're lacking generally. They're lacking in their spirit. They're lacking in their self-confidence. They're lacking in their self-esteem because of what they're missing, right? And therefore, giving with a smile, giving when you uplift the person, giving when you give the person a nice warm hello, giving with dignity so you show the person that you want to give, that's a whole nother level. It's the next level up. It's a whole nother level. The reason why it's only number seven coming up is because the Rambam then goes, like, giving after being asked with or anticipating the person needs, so it's going out of your way to help a person even if it's not asked. Then he talks about anonymous giving, and the Rambam is very into anonymous giving, and therefore he goes to the second to highest level, where he says, is to give to a poor person without knowing to whom you're giving and without the recipient knowing to from whom he got it. That's according to the Rambam, that's complete anonymous giving, although you don't even know who you're giving to. And the person doesn't even know who he's getting from, so there's no embarrassment. So you giving is pure because you have no agenda, you're not helping a particular person, and the person is not embarrassed because he has no idea who it's coming from, right? So what's the greatest level of giving then? Says the Rambam, the greatest level of helping someone is to set them up on their own feet, is actually a loan, not charity. Now, obviously it's not always possible. Sometimes a person needs charity, so they need charity, right? But he says the highest level is, and the highest level of dignity is, when you give a person a lifelong gift. You help them with a loan, obviously without pressuring them and so on, but you help them and you help them use that loan properly so they can set themselves up on their own feet and they can be independent. And he says that he includes that in the levels of giving charity. And in fact, this comes from a piece in the Talmud, which is considered the highest form of tzedakah. Right? If a person comes to you and says, no, I don't want a handout, but I do want a loan, that's actually the highest loan of tzedakah. Because you're helping a person with the greatest dignity. The person has no feeling then, it's, we help each other. The world was created to be giving and receiving. But if a person can then say, listen, I want to try and do this, or you can help them try and do it on their own, use it and then come back, and then I'm not in a hurry, whatever the case is, but it's a loan where they don't feel that they owe the world something, that's the greatest level of dignity. And that's the highest level of tzedakah according to the Rambam. So that's just an interesting little concept. Now, I wanted to discuss a little bit what the Rambam writes about stress and anxiety. I just think again, it's stuff we know today a lot, but it's just amazing how in his time he was able to highlight these things and so ahead of modern. I mean, you know, we talk about Freud being the father of modern psychology, and now we moved on to positive psychology. This is 12th century stuff, right, which is amazing. So I'm basing it on an article written by a guy called David Zulberg, who is, he holds an MA from Columbia University, and he studied herbal medicine, which fits in because herbal medicine, of course, was very popular in the Rambam's time. So he studied a lot. So he's coming from a sort of a medical point of view. So he says like this. He says one of the most famous medical doctors, of course, was the Rambam, who wrote a wealth of medical stuff. And he says there's a very well-known journal that he wrote called The Regimen of Health. It's got some Latin name, which I'm not going to attempt to pronounce. Right? Now, what the Rambam talks about in that particular Regimen of Health is, first of all, the connection between the mental and the physical health. Right? Now, in the last 100 years, this has become a big thing in medicine, in modern medicine, in the last number of years particularly. But the Rambam wrote about it already then, and he said there's an absolute connection between mental health and physical. First of all, they both exist. Not only do they both exist, but they both are connected, right? And he said, he discusses the especially in relation to stress and anxiety. He says, while the relationship between the mind and the body has only been, this is what this author writes, has only been really acknowledged by the medical field in the last 100 years, Maimonides was aware of this connection in the 12th century, making him a pioneer in this development, right? Now, this journal was published again in 1477, and here are some of the snippets from what he writes over there. He says like this. The Rambam writes, if emotional stress is maintained for a long period, one will definitely become ill, physically ill, right? Now, today there's so much in modern psychology about the negative physical effects of stress, right? But the Rambam wrote this back then. He said, constant anxiety damages the body, right? And then he says, the physician, the Rambam writes, the physician should think that every sick person, I'm not sure exactly what this word means, has a constricted heart, while every healthy person has a broad state of consciousness. Therefore, he says, the physician should remove from the patient all emotional activities that lead to anxiety. In other words, what he's saying is that a doctor cannot just treat the symptom. He cannot just treat that for specific, holistic medicine, in other words, he's talking about, right? In other words, you've got to be able to, a really good physician will not just say, well, you suffer from headaches, so I'm going to prescribe you something, or whatever illness it is. A really good physician will say, what else is going on in your life? And what are we going to do about that? Now, maybe the physician can't do anything about it. He might need to refer to someone else, which is fine. But he writes a really good doctor, which still applies, right? He's someone who actually can tap into other things that's going on in the patient's life that might be stressful or might be the cause of anxiety, which the physician needs to understand and appreciate, which is now, of course, confirmed in modern medicine, that it's having an effect on the physical health of the person, which is quite amazing, right? And he says, this way the health of the patient is preserved. The principle takes precedence in the cure of any patient, especially if his illness is specific to this area like depression. Now, just talking about depression, the Rambam wrote quite a bit about depression, actually, in different places. Those who heard my series on mental health and Judaism, I actually make mention. Even in the 8 chapters I mentioned before, in the 8 chapters of the Rambam that he wrote as introduction to Pirkei Avot, he mentions this concept of being depressed there. Now, in ancient times, it was called Morash Chayra. In the Yiddish, there's a word, Morash Chayra. But it comes from the word Marash Chara. Because in the thinking in the Rambam's times, which according to Rabbi Dr. Tversky actually was an old-fashioned thinking, but confirms a much more modern way of thinking, there was this concept of the 4 biles, the 4 juices that are in the body, white, yellow, black, and red, I think it is, right? And when there's an imbalance, this can cause physical illness. And the Rambam writes over there that depression comes from Mara Shchora, an imbalance of black juice, right? Whatever, I'm not sure exactly what that means. But what about Dr. Tversky says is what, you know, when Freud came along, Freud didn't see depression as a physiological thing at all. It was only much later, actually through some blood pressure medicine, anecdotally, that they discovered that there could be something happening in the body. Now, it's a combination of mental stuff and physiological stuff, but the Rambam really wrote then that it could be a physiological thing to do with depression, but he writes over here that it's also triggered by a lot of mental stuff. So therefore, when you're dealing with someone, whatever illness it is, you need to deal with the emotional and mental stuff that is happening. And he writes that the physician should not think that medical knowledge alone can set aside emotional instabilities. You need to deal with it from a psychological point of view as well, and that in turn will help the physical illness, right? Then he says, now listen to this, talking about modern day mindfulness, right? Look at this. The Rambam writes like this: contemplation alone reduces bad thoughts, anxiety, and distress, because most Most thoughts that cause distress, sorrow, sadness, or grief occurs from one of the two things. So the Rambam acknowledges that emotional stress sometimes is physiological. That's what he says elsewhere. But he also says a lot of times triggered by negative thinking. And he says the negative thinking comes from one of two things. Either one thinks of the past, like the loss of money or a beloved one. In other words, you get trapped in the past, basically. Right? Or one thinks of something that may occur in the future, like a possible loss or injury, and one fears they're coming. Right? Another way of saying this is, the Rambam is saying, you got to be in the present. Now, he's not saying you should acknowledge the past. The Rambam, we've talked about this many times, even in grief, right? You have to mourn, you have to grieve, you have to express a negative emotion. But he said, yet it is known that through rational observation, this is CBT, right? Cognitive behavioral therapy, dealing with your thoughts, learning how to be in the present. Yet it is known through rational observation that thinking about the past is of no benefit at all, right? Sorrow and grief over the past are activities of those who lack the influence of the intellect. In other words, you have to use your mind to control what you're feeling, right? There's no difference in a person who grieves or lost money or something else, or a person, right? So we are human. We do grieve, but we have to move away from it. He says, similarly, any anxiety that results from thoughts about what may happen in the future are pointless, because every possible thing lies in the realm of possibility. Maybe it will happen, maybe it will not, right? Let a person replace anxiety with hope in God, and with this hope it is possible that in fact the opposite of what one fears will actually happen, because both of what one fears and its opposite are equally in the realm of possibility. Now, again, he's not saying don't plan, right? We've talked about this when we talked about mindfulness. Obviously, you have to live a healthy life. You have to plan for the future. You have to take decisions now that affect the future. But just worrying about the future is going to cause anxiety and stress, right? Today, we know that mindfulness exercises, mindfulness living, reduces stress, reduces anxiety, reduces depression. It's been used clinically today, right? John Kabat-Zinn has a whole clinic where he uses mindfulness to reduce stress and anxiety, and it's exactly what this is, right? All in the writings of the Rambam. And then he says a very, very interesting thing. He said, however, it is clear, no, so this author writes, it's clear that Maimonides maintain that stress and anxiety sometimes require medical treatments. Now, this is interesting, right? Again, the combination of psychology and psychiatry. So although the Rambam says you got to use cognitive thinking and control your thoughts and learn not to get trapped in the future and so on and so forth and the past, it is also clear that the Rambam acknowledges, like I said before, that sometimes it's physiological, and therefore he says you need medicine back then, right? Now, obviously, the medication he had then wasn't the medication we have today, although the Rambam was very, very into all sorts of different herbal combinations, many of which are now used today in herbal medicine. So obviously he didn't have the medication that we have today for clinical depression, things like that, but this author writes that some of the stuff that nowadays they use, like lavender and other sort of herbal concoctions for depression, are actually in that journal where the Rambam talks about the herbs that you should use for depression, which I thought was just amazing. But the lesson from it is really, really important. In other words, this is not just a modern discovery. These are things which are ancient, in ancient Jewish wisdom, written by the Rambam, and it is really important, this concept of controlling our thoughts. So it highlights the stuff that we've been talking about a lot of, in terms of mindful thinking, being in the present, and the Jewish support for those sort of things. Now, we have not so long left, but I want to just talk about the last thing, which is a bit of a sad story. The Rambam created a huge controversy. And during his life, he was not actually accepted by the entire Jewish world, because he was very revolutionary, he was very creative, and he caused a lot of problems, particularly not so much in the Sephardic world, but in the Ashkenazic world. So while he was living in Cairo, and this undisputed great leader, he was being challenged in France, where the Ashkenazim lived. And at that time, there were some great rabbis, including someone known as Rabbeinu Yona, and they opposed the Rambam. They really opposed the Rambam for a number of reasons. First of all, they didn't even like his magnum opus, the Mishnah Torah. They felt that he'd written it. Normally, when you write Talmudic, halachic stuff, you have to give sources, you have to give references. They felt that just writing something without any source, without any references, is dangerous, and it's the Jewish law can be damaged by it, and so on and so forth. Some of his explanations that he came up of in the Guide to Perplexed were really novel and new, and they were really, really against it. Now, I want to point out something, that in the Jewish tradition, all the way through, this happens every number of generations, there's a tremendous resistance to change, for good reason. So often what happens is, change happens, but it happens in a difficult way. This was true with the Baal Shem Tov, it was true with the Rambam, it was true with the Arizal, it was true with many, many, many great sages when they introduced new things. Why is this? Because we know that change is dangerous. One of the things that's so sacred to Judaism and Jewish belief and Jewish practice is tradition and the eternity of the values of Torah, not to replace them with anything new. So therefore, even when change happens, it's got to happen where it's completely consistent with the ultimate kernel of truth, right? So therefore, there were, and to prove that their resistance and their fear of change is legitimate, there were things that happened throughout Jewish tradition which were changed, which were for the bad. Like, for example, Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi was a false messiah who captured the hearts and minds of a very large part of the Jewish community, in fact, one could say the majority of the Jewish community, and ended up an absolute disaster and ended up in a really low morale for the entire Jewish nation, right? Because they didn't challenge him properly. That is why when the Baal Shem Tov came along, for example, introduced the Hasidic movement, which happened not so long after Shabtai Tzvi, there was fierce opposition, because they thought, oh no, we have a new Shabtai Tzvi coming along here now. Until it became apparent that no. And the proof of the pudding is, of course, like the Rambam and the Baal Shem Tov and all these people is, that when you see that they came only to strengthen Judaism, not to weaken it, then it becomes apparent. But at the beginning, the resistance to change in its own right is not a bad thing. What is problematic is what you do with it. And the rabbis in France took it one step too far, which they acknowledged themselves was wrong, and that they banned the Rambam's works. And unfortunately, in 1232, there was a burning of the Rambam's works in France, right? And they banned everyone from learning the Grat Perplex and selling the Rambam, and they sort of shunned him out. I mean, in the Sephardic world, he was still being celebrated as a great sage, but 12 years later, now they evolved, it's a long story how they burnt Rambam, they evolved some of the Christian authority and so on and so forth. But 12 years later, in France, not far from where the Rambam's works were burnt, the Christian rulers at the time, this had to do with the Crusaders and so on, had a public burning of the Talmud. And they burned the famous thing when they burned 20 wagon loads of manuscripts of the Talmud, leaving the Jewish nation almost without the Talmud, because there was no printing press in those days, it was only manuscripts. They gathered all these manuscripts and they burnt it. Rabbeinu Yonah, this great sage, and he was a great sage, and this is a sign of a great sage, when you reflect and you go back and you think, maybe what I did was wrong. Rabbeinu Yonah looked at this and he said, no, it's a punishment from God. Obviously, we did the wrong thing. We were wrong about the Rambam. Now, that in itself is a great lesson, right? We know that making a mistake is a part of the human being. Admitting a mistake is the greatness of the human being. And throughout history, there are many people that never admitted mistakes, and that was always
so
a problem.
So he called the rabbis for writing the letter and said,
there was no WhatsApps in those days, but I'm not even sure if he could do that, because I believe by the time, I'm not even sure if this happened, after I look at this history, it could even be this happened after the death of the Rambam, really. But what he did do is, and I didn't know this till very recently, I did know there's a very famous work of Rabbeinu Yonah called Sha'arei Tshuva, The Gates of Repentance, which is studied in many communities, particularly in the time of Elul. Right? Elul is a month of Tshuva, so very famous work where people study it if they want to take the concept of repentance and improvement seriously. I only got to know recently that Rabbeinu Yonah wrote this for his own Tshuva, to repent for the fact that he made a mistake. He meant well, he was scared of the change, and it was somewhat legitimate. He did take it too far, and he repented fully, and today the Rambam is obviously undisputed and celebrated as an unbelievable sage. So those are just some of the things I thought was interesting, and I thought just we'd share that, the foundation of personal growth, ideas of giving, the mental health perspective of the Rambam, which I think is completely ahead of his time and unbelievably fascinating, and how change works, and how sometimes we have to know the balance between questioning change but at the same time not taking it too far and admitting our mistakes when we make it. Okay, one more week, as I said, next week we draw the raffle, one more week left.